Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes photography unique as an art form, and how have scholars, critics, and audiences used metaphors to link photography to older artistic traditions and concepts? The introduction of photography as a form of expression, scientific inquiry, and documentation struck many observers as a watershed moment, and its ongoing evolution continues to challenge practitioners, critics, and patrons. So how have we made sense of what photography means in the nearly two centuries that have elapsed since the production of the first permanent photographic image? Roberto Tejada is a poet and endowed professor of art history at SMU. Jessica May is associate curator of photographs at the Amon Carter Museum of Art, which is hosting the exhibition The Medium and Its Metaphors through September 2nd. They will both be speaking on the subject this Thursday, May 10th at the Amon Carter. Jessica, Roberto, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having us.
So from the beginning, photography was understood to be this sort of bridge between art and science. How did that affect the way it was used early on by people who were practicing photography, and also how did it affect the way it was discussed by people who wanted to understand this new thing?
That's an interesting question. In the British tradition in particular, which is perhaps a tradition that I know best from the early years, photography is really an invention of a group of aristocrats, men who have both time and money and very good educations. And they're very learned in a classical tradition, which involves aesthetics, but they're also amateur scientists. So William Henry Fox Talbot, who in England is the first person who lays claim to an image that will stick, and it's on paper rather than in France, where the image is on metal, and it's called a daguerreotype. He's someone who comes out of a scientific tradition, and so he's the person who coins the term the pencil of nature by virtue of bridging that which is aesthetic, that which is an image, with a long-held desire to create something that is magically automatic and an actual image of nature.
Mm-hmm. So for the first time, from Talbot's perspective, you can get something that looks as much like the real thing as in the past only the finest human artists could duplicate.
Exactly. And artists and travelers and these kind of men of the countryside, men of the state, had long wanted photographs before they were made. We have these wonderful essays and diaristic accounts of the first decades of the 19th century. Photography is really announced as an invention in 1839. But in the decades preceding 1839, you have these great accounts of these men saying, I want to fix an image of the sun. Mm-hmm. And they'll sort of be out in their boat on an Italian countryside wishing for and thinking about what it would take to fix the image of that moment.
Would you say it goes back also to the Renaissance? There has been a long tradition of wanting to use optics as a way of facilitating representation or art making. And so, for example, the camera obscura was one way of doing this. Mm-hmm. The camera lucida was another way of doing this, creating a lens so that the image desired was transposed onto a wall in which the artist could then design or draw upon that, so that it comes out of this natural marriage between the available chemistry at the time and the science of optics that was then current.
Of course, there was early on resistance. Baudelaire was one who said, too much photography means the death of art, that we will no longer have a human touch in representing the world.
Well, this is one of the great topics that Jessica has developed in this exhibition, which is that with the invention of photography as a bridge between art and science, or chemistry and optics, it is also the prompt for all kinds of writing about photography, mm-hmm. writing about this problem. And I think what the exhibition does is precisely determine or identify the different modes or the different metaphors, as Jessica calls them, rightfully so, that writers, poets, photographers themselves have coined to talk about this very problem, about the fact that photography creates an anxiety, threatens to undermine the project of artistic or imaginative creation.
Do you think part of that tension comes from the fact that even in the early days, I mean, you had to have money and resources, but certainly in the 20th century, photography was available maybe not good photography, but the medium was available for practice by people who were not experts, who had not spent years on something in a way that, you know, painting and sculpture and poetry, for that matter, mm-hmm. never were.
It's a hugely democratizing medium, and I think that's one of the reasons, one of the questions I sort of have about photography is, why do we think of it with a small p? We usually think about a single painting, a single painter, individual works of art, but we think about photography as a class. And I think it is the fact that it has this kind of democratizing aspect to it that makes us kind of wonder about it as a medium and as a form of technology that's so important in our lives. That democratizing aspect has two components. One is that it makes everything in the world seem like you could capture it. Mm-hmm. And the other is that it makes everyone in the world a potential renderer or artist of the world.
So it both elevates and cheapens the form.
I'm not so
sure. No, I think that's true. I think that that is the basis of this moment you pointed to of Baudelaire sort of having this sense of anxiety about what photography could be. What's interesting is that most of the early writers on photography, on some level, are worried about rank and status. They're mm-hmm. worried about what happens to the other arts. Can literature or painting be deposed? And some writers are a little bit more kind of blunt on that point than others, but everybody's a little bit worried. And so I do think that sense of both the elevation and the celebration of the world through its photographic image, but also just the status anxiety around what photography will do to the other arts is a huge part of the history of the medium.
But there were people who were excited about the emergence of photography, and Oliver Wendell Holmes seems to have been quite a champion of it.
Yes, maybe you can talk about his
idea
of the universal currency, and which led to a very productive conversation between the two of us.
Yes, Saturday afternoon, Roberto and I spent hours talking about exactly this point. Wendell Holmes is this fabulous Bostonian writer. He's the first writer who's in the show who's of American descent. And he writes an essay in the late 1850s, really celebrating photography for what he proposes is its exchange value, which is a radically strange idea for us now. We take for granted that the primary mode of exchange is money. But at this moment in the antebellum America, when all manner of objects in the world, their value is shifting. I mean, this is a moment when America is in incredible upheaval, and he proposes that what is magical about photography, and he's thinking specifically about a kind of technology called the stereograph, is that it could be so literal and it could be so transparent to everyone. It means a photograph means the same thing to everyone in the world, that it could be a kind of universal bank or a universal mode of exchange.
And while these images are have this incredible distribution, there is that sense of a connectivity between individual subjectivities, because you know that as you're putting your eyes into the stereograph viewer, that you're doing something that some other subject in some other part of the world is also doing. Mm-hmm. And maybe I can just read that very short piece that he published in The Atlantic, I believe, which is also which he was involved in its production, where he says something, as the means of facilitating the formation of public and private stereographic collections, there must be arranged a comprehensive system of exchanges so that there may grow up something like a universal currency of these banknotes or promises to pay in solid substance, which the sun has engraved for the great bank of nature. Hmm. So there's also this idea that Jessica and I were discussing the other day of that the photograph, be it the stereograph or otherwise, is a promissory note, that it does not only capture what is in the frame of viewing or in the field of vision, but it projects something into a future which hasn't yet happened.
Yeah. Well, there's also this this early idea that media would be something that would unite people. I mean, people mm-hmm. can grow up in any part mm-hmm. of the United States, and if mm-hmm. they saw the same images, watched the same TV shows, read the same books, they have a common frame of reference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an idea that in some ways is so simple that it's easy to take for granted, mm-hmm. but it's incredibly utopian that the world could be united through a common visual language of photography. I find it almost touchingly, heartbreakingly utopian, because, of course, now we live in a completely media-saturated culture, and we know how well that the world is not united over the universality of images And yet I think we still hope for that.
My guests this hour are Jessica May, who is Associate Curator of Photographs at the Amon Carter Museum of Art, and Roberto Tejada, who is a poet and endowed professor of art history at SMU. They will both be lecturing on Thursday, May 10th at the Amon Carter, which is hosting the exhibition The Medium and Its Metaphors through September 2nd. If you'd like to join this conversation, we have lines open now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Jeff Whittington is back in studio now. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, Chris. So here's how it's working this hour. We have an anonymous donor from Flower Mound who has called and said, I'll give you $500, KERA, if 50 of your Think listeners will make a contribution before 2 p.m. So it's already 1:17. So we're starting, 17 minutes down here. We have 43 minutes to garner 50 contributions at any level from you at 888-694-6931 or via the web at kera.org.
The process of making your contribution is anxiety-free, takes about 2 minutes. If you call in to 1-888-694-6931, can go even faster depending on how fast your fingers can fly if you go online to kera.org. If you are interested in a thank you gift, we have all the books that we have talked about from Think over the past couple of weeks. We also have lots of other things. If you've heard people mentioning something and you said, I really wanted that This American Life thumb drive or one of the different things we have on offer, they're all still available. Just go online and you can hook yourself up with those.
I want to thank a couple of people who have contributed in the last hour. These don't count toward our 50 this hour, unfortunately, but big thanks to Allison McStravick in Corinth, Carrie Baldwin and Ty Melton in Dallas, Julia Graves in Dallas. I think that's Dr. Julia Graves. Hello, Dr. Graves. Tammy Cancella in Colleyville, Jonathan Anthony Newland and Trung Ho in Dallas, and Rebecca Block and Larry McFall in Granbury. We'd love to hear from you, especially right now. We have 48 contributions remaining in our 50 contribution goal by 2 p.m. And remember, an anonymous donor from Flower Mound wants to give KERA $500, but they just can't bring themselves to do it unless we garner 50 contributions from you. You can make 50 contributions, but really it'd be better if you just made one.
Just make
and
one.
47 other of you called as well, 888-694-6931, or go online to kera.org.
If you've never done it before, maybe you want to set up a sustaining membership, which maybe sounds like a giant commitment, but in fact, it's just a monthly contribution. A lot of people set it up at $10 a month, but you can do five, you can do 50, you can do $125 a month and actually find yourself a Friends level member of the station. Your contribution does matter. You know, if you think, well, it doesn't matter if one person calls, do you hear us counting back from 50, 48, then we're at 46, right. Now we're at 43. We're going one by one here. So your one matters at 1-888-694-6931.
Although so far, to be precise, it's been 2, 2, and 3 so far. So several of you are calling in at the same time.
In little tiny groups.
Proving that we do indeed have the technology to take as many of your calls or as many of your online contributions at once as possible. So we'd love to be able to achieve this goal. Our last hour goal, we fell a little short, too. We were trying to raise $7,000 to stay on track to get really within striking distance of finishing this drive very, very soon. We could make up some of that ground, too, by making this goal this hour. Call 888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org. If you listened last hour and you enjoyed the conversation with John Long, author of Darwin's Devices, What Evolving Robots Can Teach Us About the History of Life and the Future of Technology, well, that's still available when you join the station at a $120 membership level. Don't wait. Call 888-694-6931 or go to kera.org and contribute now.
Support this radio station that brings to you every conversation under the sun, except sports, maybe. But we talk about just about everything else at 1-888-694-6931. Your financial donation to this station really does make a difference. It will bring you good radio for another year, and it will bring it to your entire community, which is only made better by the existence of public radio. You can also make your contribution online at kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Jessica May, Associate Curator of Photographs at the Amon Carter Museum of American Art, and Roberto Tejada, who is a poet and endowed professor of art history at SMU. Both will be lecturing this coming Thursday, May 10th, at the Amon Carter, which is hosting the exhibition The Medium and Its Metaphors through September 2nd. If you would like to join our conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Roberto, talk about this. What is the relationship between photography and literature beyond simply criticism that is written about photography?
I mean, I would say that photography, especially in the modernist moment, provides an alternate modality or an alternate technique for writing the poetic line. And one of them, the most important, and I think this is very true of Anglo-American modernism, but also that of Latin America, is the idea that the page is also a space. That is, if one of the assumptions about photography that's often forgotten is that you look at a photograph and it's absolute flatness, mm-hmm. and yet it's providing this sense of depth and depth of field. And there is also an assumption about the poem prior to its breaking free, especially in the 20th century, of consigned or formats or pre-established formats, that the spatial layout of the poem has as much to do with its content as the subject that it's referring to the moment. And that also one of the, I think, important things was also this idea of the arrest, of the break, what was beforehand the caesura, especially in poetry, as I'm thinking of, the ability to move from one content to the next really comes from the ways in which, when photography is used in mass communications like magazines, journals, newspapers, the ways in which one can juxtapose one photographic data next to another and create these very interesting, unlikely fusions and explosions.
It was interesting for me in preparing for this show because I gave some thought to a conversation we had last year with Errol Morris about the reality that, you know, we look at a photograph and we think about the contents of the photograph and what's contained within that frame. And to really fully explore it, you also have to consider what might have been left out. And it's the same with poetry, and yet we don't necessarily think in the same terms about the poem as a document.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think one of the particularities of photography, perhaps more than any of the other visual genres, is the fact that the frame is the most important aspect of the photograph, or at least as important as what's within the frame, because there's an exclusionary practice that takes place, both in terms of time, what happened in the instant before the photograph that we're looking at, and what happened afterwards, but also what kind of social information is not included in what we're looking at so close. And so with the poem, I think this is also true, that is, to the degree to which a line and where it ends tells us something about what's being silenced or not being said or suppressed or somehow obscured.
Did it take a while, Jessica, for thinkers to start considering that? Was everybody so hung up on the contents of the photograph itself early on that nobody considered what was left out?
No, I think it's been a subject of great interest for people throughout photography's history, but I think that it becomes a subject of kind of intellectual inquiry in the sense that to be a critic of photography is also to be a critic of one's own moment and of the kind of broader issues that surround one's moment. And so I don't think you really get until the early 20th century, and I'm thinking particularly of the work of someone like Walter Benjamin, who for me is this kind of huge figure in terms of thinking through what is not in photography as well as what is in a single photograph. And as much as he's writing about photography at that moment, he is writing about his own universe of Germany in the 1930s. Roberto, would you agree with that?
I would. And I think there's also, even in the early techniques, the daguerreotype and so forth, calotype, there is a sense that the photograph is recording something that belongs, and this comes from the romantic moment, a historical consciousness of some sort, because what you're looking at is no longer there.
Hmm. Yeah, it was a moment in time.
Yes, and it's extracted from time. It's this cross-section of time, so that somehow that does convey a presence that is actually about an absence.
Yes, that's very helpful, because as I think about it, if we go back to this moment when the great French critic and flaneur, Charles Baudelaire, is walking the streets of Paris and complaining bitterly about how photography will ruin everything. I mean, not really, but I have this mental image that I rather like.
We do that now with new technologies.
Yes, exactly. And he is saying, let it be a souvenir for artists, for writers. Let it reinforce this hierarchy that we spoke of earlier. And it's interesting to put it in this particular frame of what of a concern about what is the relationship between what's in the image and what is not. Because, of course, souvenir, the frame there is the frame of time. Let it be a memory of that which we cannot have in front of us now. Mm-hmm. That's its proper place. So.
And was it Walter Benjamin who was focused on the idea that it would essentially the photographic image is a record of something that passed by so quickly that the eye couldn't have taken it all in?
Precisely. Mm-hmm. So he coins this term, and he's borrowing from a recently coined term in psychoanalysis, which of course we'll all be familiar with now, it's the unconscious, mm-hmm. Which seems to rule everything. He coins the term the optical unconscious, which many grad students have spent many, many hours talking about it at length, but in a sense, there's a simplicity to this idea which is quite beautiful. And the simplicity is that the optical unconscious is a phrase by which we understand how photography segments time into seemingly infinite bits so small that with our eyes we don't understand what's going on. And then photography allows us to see it. So the classic example is a man taking a step. We think we understand in advance of looking at a photograph the precise nature of taking your first step. But it's not until a photograph segments time that we actually have to check ourselves and have to think, oh, that is exactly what it looks like to take that step.
Mm-hmm. And in a sense, I would also add that just what Benjamin tells us so poignantly is that the visual field is never 100% successful, and that a photograph is the evidence of this. And that between the evidence of the photograph and what we see in our visual field, there has to be some remainder, something left over that allows history to happen.
But then sometimes the photograph becomes the memory itself. We're so familiar mm-hmm. with an image, and I'm thinking of the very famous image of the child running from the napalm attack in mm-hmm. Vietnam. And first of all, I think if we were to see a video of the exact same scene, I don't think we would notice the expression on her face in mm-hmm. quite the same way. Mm-hmm. Most of us on the planet today were not there when that happened. There might be a person or two still alive, and yet that's become a memory that we never actually experienced.
Oh, I agree. I mean, I would say that Benjamin would be very much in agreement with this insofar as I think that there's something about the still image that tells us more than film or video footage mm-hmm. because its ability to arrest a moment in time that in the course of history we have to fill in, and that it stands for, it's a placeholder for a nexus of textures and feelings and structures that we can only have access through that one particular arrested moment.
Mm-hmm. And the arrested moment itself, on the one hand, there is, as we keep going back and forth, there's the temporal dimension, which is this is a single moment, but there's also the spatial dimension, which is all of the details that make up that single instant in time fill the space of the picture. And so to really be able to stop and examine a face, then it becomes an experience that kind of has a duration. So absolutely, that seems to be the source of the resonance of these kind of crucial images that become our memory of public culture.
And there's much invested in that, insofar as even national projects are involved in certain specific still images, so that mm-hmm. I've done some research on the Mexican Revolution, and this one archive that is the Casasola Archive is so often referred to that pulls those historic moments and makes them into icons that therefore were convenient for the state thereafter 1914, for example, to turn Villa and Zapata into these heroes. Mm-hmm. Right?
I wonder why we're drawn to certain mediated forms of communication that actually take us away from some of our senses. You know, there is the still photograph, mm-hmm. and then there is video, and people are still drawn to the still photograph, even though video theoretically could show you more. I mean, I work mm-hmm. in this old-fashioned medium of radio that everybody said would die, and yet there's something about listening to a conversation without the visual images. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing your faces here, but people listening aren't, and yet there's some kind of attention that you are able to pay when you don't have every sense engaged.
We still read novels.
Yeah, exactly.
It's fun. I mean, it's interesting being in the museum field and working specifically as a curator of photographs at this moment when photography, in a way, is actually passing out of the existence that we used to know it as. I mean, photography, as much as it's everywhere, is in some ways being eclipsed by different technologies, and certainly old-fashioned photography has totally been eclipsed by digital. And
the physical artifact.
Or old-fashioned, film-based photography has been eclipsed by digital forms of production, which are absolutely flood our lives. And yet, at this very moment, if anything, the value of photographic collections to the general public seem to be increasing. And the evidence of that are more curatorial positions, more photographs going into public collections. So there is something paradoxical but deeply, deeply human about that seeking out of something that satisfies a single sense in a deep and resonant way.
And I think it speaks to different kinds of vehicles. One of the great things about photography is that it exists in different kinds of supports, so that a photograph in a fine art book is just as valid in many ways as one that we see hanging in the Amon Carter, for example, or that's framed, for example, or one we see in an album. And so that it also activates different kinds of viewerships, so that if I'm at the museum looking at a photograph, I'm also just as interested in the viewers moving closer and forward, closer and backwards to a particular image, because of the way that it can detain our viewership in certain kinds of ways. Ways in which a photograph, for example, will also create different kinds of, will activate different things when it's next to text. Because we, and this is one of the things about photography that I think this show proves, is that it is so reliant on writing and text for its ultimate meanings.
My guests this hour are poet Roberto Tejada, who is endowed professor of art history at SMU, and Jessica May, associate curator of photographs at the Amon Carter Museum of American Art. The Amon Carter is hosting the exhibition The Medium and Its Metaphors through September 2nd, and Roberto and Jessica will be speaking on Thursday, May 10th about it. If you would like to join the conversation, we already have an email that we will read in the next segment that's come in to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. If you are ready to support public radio, to support conversations like this one, and to support civil discourse in your community, you can give us a call at 1-888-694-6931 or make a contribution online at kera.org.
I want to remind everybody that an anonymous donor from Flower Mound will donate an additional $500. If we hear from 50 Think listeners during this hour before 2 p.m., Chris, about 36 left to go.
36 left to go. You can make your contribution now at 1-888-694-6931, or you can go to kera.org.
We did get a comment from Jen in the Think inbox. She says, thank you so much for this conversation, this exhibit at the Amon Carter. Jen says, I'm a photographer currently working with Pinhole and developing my images at home, and I find that what I capture, often unintentional, has a powerful impact on me and reveals ideas and experiences that I cannot express with words. This is how I peek into my unconscious. So thanks so much for your message, Jen. We want to thank Hema Dapalapudi and Raj Adusumili in Coppell and Renee Barrera in Dallas. I want to thank Mark Vamos in Dallas for supporting the station, Jessica Conklin, Aisha Qureshi in Fort Worth, and Joseph Pilaf in Flower Mound, and also Edith and Thorsten Prutz in Carrollton. These folks are helping us whittle down this goal. And remember, it's a $500 challenge. We've got to hear from at least 50 contributors during the 1 o'clock hour today by 2 p.m., and we're still looking for 36 contributions.
You only have to be one of those contributions if you haven't done so yet in this campaign. After you do, however, please evangelize for us. Let your friends on social media know that you are a proud supporter of KERA. Sometimes it just takes waking people up to the fact that their friends, their neighbors and associates are members of the station to remind them that, hey, this is something you can do. It's certainly affordable because you get to decide the amount you want to contribute to the station. I know in this drive, we've had contributions from, at least during this show, as low as $20, as high as $2,400 from individuals who just called in to 1-888-694-6931 or went online to kera.org.
Remember the number, it's 888-694-6931. or click and join at kera.org. Want to thank our guests for being here and being really patient as they sit, you know, inches away from
a
pledge break.
This is how the sausage is made.
That's right. That's right. This is a really great conversation. And if you are enjoying it today, and I know that we're hearing from you on the phone and we're hearing from you in the email inbox, well, we want you to also support it, because that's what this is all about. We take these membership campaigns these times, three times a year, to come to you and ask you to support the station. And we're thrilled to be able to tell our story. And, you know, you're a part of that story. As Chris said earlier, when you make your call, when you make your online contribution, you help make this station that you listen to, that you use every day, a reality.
I love meeting those of you who listen out just in the course of day-to-day life when people find out where I work. I can always tell that you've made a contribution, because only the people who have made a contribution say, hey, I'm a regular subscriber. Lots of people say, hey, I love the show. And then it gets silent. Wouldn't it be nice to know that you have supported the program that means so much to you if you happen to run into Jeff somewhere buying chicken feed or doing anything in the community?
That's why you always write checks, though, right, Chris? So people will see your name and go, oh, where do I know that name from?
I have not written a check since about 1997.
I'm kidding.
No, you know, you meet people in the world, and you're all very kind, those of you who listen to the show. We really appreciate it. We hear from a lot of you, not just on the show, but, you know, you email us and let us know what you think.
I carry around a little pad of pledge forms, actually, in my pocket. And so when I meet somebody, I can just tear off a pledge form and hand it right to them. Not really. All that's fake. I made up all that stuff. It's all false.
It were available to you.
That's right. This is what happens when I've been here since like 5:45 or something. I was a little late this morning. Actually, I got a text from Jeff Ramirez at 6:03 that said, are you here to pitch? And I was at my desk. So I ran into the control room just in the nick of time. But this is what happens. Sorry. But, you know, This is real. This is really happening right here. I'm melting down during the membership campaign.
Please stop Jeff's meltdown and make a contribution now. We have 35 left to go. 1-888-694-6931 is the way to go. Remember, we're working on this challenge grant.
Yeah, an anonymous donor from Flower Mound will contribute an additional $500 if 50 Think listeners will make a contribution to KERA by 2 p.m. We've got about 20 minutes to do that. 34 contributions left to go. Please call 888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org and make your contribution right now.
If you would like to receive a copy of the book from the last hour, John Long's Darwin's Devices, about those evolving robots, we have those still available. You make a contribution at or above the $120 level at 1-888-694-6931 or kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Roberto Tejada, who is a poet and endowed professor of art history at SMU, and Jessica May, associate curator of photographs at the Amon Carter Museum of American Art. They'll be lecturing this coming Thursday, May 10th, at the Amon Carter. The museum is hosting the exhibition The Medium and Its Metaphors through September 2nd. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So was it like the 1930s and 40s? That was the point at which photography as a potential artistic medium was no longer challenged by anyone serious?
Oh, gosh. There are still plenty of people who will say, oh, it has no place in museums. But I think photography diversifies dramatically after the late 1920s, and there just seems to be more room for photographic production across all kind of ranks and places in both art and public culture. So photography starts being collected by museums in America in the late 20s through the 30s. There's a lot of photographers working during that period, and people start seeing photography in magazines and a lot more in newspapers during that period.
That's what I was going to say, that there's a paradox there, because on the one hand, photography begins to gain credence as an art form, or at least as a form of visual meaning-making, and yet at the same time, it's even becoming more pervasive in ways that make it easy to dismiss it as a kind of art form, mm-hmm. especially in magazines, the mass communication magazines. And yet many of those photographers who did fashion photography or did commercial photography are now seen as being relevant to the histories of art, the histories of photography.
What's interesting, I guess in some ways Baudelaire was justified in that the people that photographers did sort of push out of the way were the artists who used to cover historic events, news mm-hmm. events. Mm-hmm. There are not too many, I suppose there are courtroom sketch artists, mm-hmm. and there are graphic artists working in news, but there aren't people doing portraits of battle scenes anymore.
No, I mean, but what's sort of interesting is how there are periods throughout the early 20th century when there are kind of other media employed. I mean, one of the great examples is the federal government in the 1930s is hiring a lot of artists to do different kinds of work under the auspices of the Federal Art Project, or in some cases, the Farm Security Administration, et cetera. Well, the Index of American Design is watercolor-based. These watercolorists went all over the country to draw aspects of the native or vernacular American design traditions. So you get some of it, but boy, non-photographic forms of documentation fall off tremendously after around 1930.
And photography has this, I don't know if the right word is problem, but reality that does not exist for other forms of art, which is you can take literature and say there is truth in this. You can take a painting, you can take a sculpture. But people, for the most part, assume that what is contained in a photograph is real.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, even one of the early practitioners of photography, Hippolyte Bayard, troubles that idea because one of his first photographs, he had been trying to get his technique approved by the French government. Daguerre beat him to the punch. So then he does a self-portrait of himself as a drowned man. He, Bayard, shirtless, in a background.
Not really dead.
Clearly.
And in the back it says something, this is the product of the photographer who, because he could not get the contracts and patents that... that were given to Monsieur Daguerre, has committed suicide. So already we know that this is a photograph that has been staged and that is playing with the very fact that this medium that, for all intents and purposes, produces a kind of one-to-one relationship with the photographed, that is the photograph and the photographed have a kind of symbiotic relationship, breaks that. Mm-hmm. And so I think, especially in terms of what you're discussing, documentary photography or photography that has the aim of being a part of social production, it goes through waves of a kind of skepticism about its function and utility.
And to that very point, photography has a very long and interesting history of relationship to legal structures and the law, because at various moments, and right now I think is a moment in which the law and the evidentiary aspect of photography, they seem to be at some peace. But at various moments, photographs may or may not be admissible as evidence, for example. There's a great 1936 example of a photograph by a federal employee named Russell Lee, who made a photograph of a skull in the Dakotas as part of the Farm Security Administration documentary project. Well, he moved the skull in order to make the photograph, and this has been a scandal for, we're going on 70 years now. So the kind of, it's as though we know that we shouldn't believe in photographs, but we're still scandalized when we have the experience of feeling lied to by them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's such an interesting case because the skull was moved and the question is, did it actually tell the story better and give a truer picture of something?
Sure.
Or did it fake something for effect?
Exactly. I mean, and that is, I think, an unanswerable question. About a year ago, I was at the Museum of Modern Art for a conversation among artists and scholars and curators called the Contemporary Forum on Photography. And an artist who I admire very much, who's been a big part of the sort of discussion about documentary in the post-1970 period, is a woman named Martha Rossler. And she posed a question to the group: are photographs true? Everyone went nuts. They were really, it
this group of people who were sort of too cool for school by definition, everyone in the room took a position that they kind of wouldn't climb, that they weren't willing to come down from, which is to say, is it true or not? In some ways, it doesn't matter. It is, on some level, a deeply impersonal medium, but we invest it with the hope of a kind of authenticity and accuracy.
I'm curious about what the split was. Was it 50-50?
It was in the neighborhood of 50-50. In the sense that what struck me about the room was how many photographers got upset with the accusation that they might, by definition, be liars for having some role in the staging or preparation for photographs. Hmm. Which is to say, if you are a documentary photographer, by virtue of conceiving of photographs and thinking about them as something that could be composed, have you already participated in an act of betrayal?
And it's funny that they sound as if they were astonished that the question would even be posed, because it seems like something that, as a documentary photographer, you'd have to at least have given a great deal of thought to, even if you finally take the position that everything you put out there is true.
Well, maybe. I mean, I guess maybe it was astonished that it was posed and taken seriously in that moment. Mm-hmm. But that said, 2 years ago at the Amon Carter, we did a symposium where we invited people in to talk about documentary production in the 1930s. And we gave about a half an hour at the end of the session for an open conversation. You were there, Roberto. You probably remember at the very end, a member of the audience, not a famous photographer, not one of the most beloved artists of the early 21st century. A member of the audience spoke up and asked this wonderful question about the truth of photography. And everyone kind of got a little prickly there, too.
I think this has to do with the vicissitudes of photography and its practice after 1970. Mm-hmm. One scholar, Douglas Crimp, talks about the invention of photography in the 19th century, but its re-enchantment or its discovery, actually, in the 1970s. And so far as then, photography is now colliding again with art practice. That is, there are artists who use photography as a medium to an end, not particularly as photographic practice. And so we might begin to think of, again, this problem. It's a recurring problem. It's the historic uncanny that comes back to haunt us about truth and lies in a photographic sense. That is, to what degree is the truth really about what obstacles are we trying to put in our way so to keep us from a sense of being historic actors?
That may take us actually back to the exhibition, because Roberto and I had this conversation the other day about the way in which the final section of the exhibition, the metaphor is the secret about a secret, which is a metaphor very different from, say, the optical unconscious or the bank of nature. Instead, that's a metaphor that suggests the more you think you know, the less you really do know. And it's a post-1970 metaphor.
That's
it's
right.
Diane Arbus, the photographer who very, very famously made these kind of enigmatic photographs that seem to be believable and yet offer up more questions than I would say they settle.
That maybe is the perfect way. We have to unfortunately leave this on the table, so hopefully that will give people an appetite to go see the entire exhibition, which will be at the Amon Carter Museum of American Art through September 2nd. Roberto Tejada and Jessica May will be speaking on Thursday, May 10th at the Amon Carter. Is that at 7?
It's at 6 p.m.
6
Thank
p.m.
you.
Thank you both so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thanks. It was a treat.
Thank you.
Thanks to all of you participating this hour as listeners, as emailers, as callers. Thanks especially for your contributions at 1-888-694-6931. We've also heard from some of you online at kera.org, where you can click on that support button and make your contribution in any amount. And you can check out thank you gifts there if there's something that you have been interested in receiving, looking at as a thank you for your participation. Again, 888-694-6931 is the telephone number, or you can go online to kera.org. Joined once again here in studio by our own Jeff Whittington, senior producer of this show, host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Chris. I want to thank Suzanne Fitzgerald and Southlake, Everett Stokes and Cleburne, Eric and Lisa Haskell and Keller and Lolita, Kulkarni and Plano. They have helped us get to just 32 contributions remaining in this hour to reach our goal of 50. Remember, there is an anonymous donor in Flower Mound who will donate an additional $500 to KERA if Think listeners will make a donation before 2 p.m. And we need at least 50 contributions by 2 p.m.
31 left to go. Please, if there's never been a better time to make your contribution than right now so that we can receive this $500 challenge. Mirjana Andreeva in Dallas, thank you so much. Thank you, Alice and Don Fulbright in Garland. Thanks so much also to Carrie and Rick Cook in Dallas. We would love to read your name. Love to thank you for your contribution to this community resource in any amount. 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also go online to kera.org. Again, the goal for the hour is 50 contributions. We have 31 yet to go. Please don't wait, because we really do require your support of the station. We want to stay on track. We're trying to get this all sewn up. You know, this is one of those experiments. We try to shorten the duration of the drive, but we cannot quit until we have the money we need to serve you. It's that simple. We'll be here for months if we need to, but we hope it'll be a matter of hours
or
days.
This is really important right now because, you know, a listener just like yourself has called up and said, hey, I want to give the station, I'm going to challenge Think listeners. This person's a fan of Think. They're an anonymous listener. They've chosen to remain anonymous. They're not anonymous, but they're a listener in Flower Mound, and they want to give the station an additional $500 in support of this show and to challenge you to make your contribution. Again, we're looking for 31 more calls at 888-694-6931 or online contributions at kera.org. We have heard from Trudy Hughes in Granbury. We've heard from Radita Bhatt in Euless and William Davis in Dallas. And we heard from John and Kim Green in Denton.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Joellen Zabel in McKinney. Thank you, Tracy Green in Grapevine. Thanks, Barbara Cox in Denton and Shay Solomon in North Richland Hills. Greatly appreciate your action right now in support of this station, either online at kera.org or over the phone at 1-888-694-6931. 30 contributions left to go in the next, it looks like about 4 minutes before we finish talking to you here.
888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. Don't forget, a donor in Flower Mound is going to give the station an additional $500, but only if we hear from 30 of you in the next couple of minutes, by 2 p.m., by 2:01, when we wrap up this membership break and before we go to the world. We really just need you to call. We really just need you to make a contribution online, because there are so many of you listening right now, so many of you who enjoyed the conversation here in this last hour with Jessica May and Roberto Tejada, who were great guests, so excited to have them on the show today. If you enjoyed that, if you got something out of that, if it resonated with you, if it made you think a little bit, well, consider what you get from this station every single day and from this program every single day, and be one of just 30 people we need to hear from, or we're going to have to essentially call this person up and say, gee, thanks so much, we're not able to accept your $500 contribution.
That is painful. I mean, I'm surprised that you were even able to choke that sentence out, because it's painful for us to think about that. $500 is a big deal. Your contribution makes it possible. Maybe you can also give us $500 or $1,500. Maybe you can do $5 a month, $10 a month. Whatever amount the contribution is in, your participation really matters. You know, every one of us who is currently a member of this station had a first time to give. And wondered, well, what'll that be like? And do I really want to do that? And I could spend that money at Target or on a pair of shoes or who knows what else. But everybody who is now a member said, no, you know what? Public radio matters. I listen all the time. I want it to be good. I want to have one of the most successful stations in the public radio system, KERA. And so I'm willing to give a little of my money to make it happen. 1-888-694-6931 or kera.org is the number to join those folks.
Yeah. 29 more contributions in any amount will help us achieve this challenge, and we'll be able to accept $500 from a listener in Flower Mound who wants Think and KERA to succeed in this membership campaign. Please be one of the next ones to call 888-694-6931. And again, if you've made a contribution already during this drive or maybe back in the winter campaign, but you can make an additional gift right now, an extra $5 or $10 or $15 or $25, that counts as a contribution toward this goal.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. Set up a sustaining membership or pay with a credit or debit card. However you want to do it, we ask that you please please take the time now to make your contribution. You can also go online to kera.org, choose to receive any number of thank you gifts, including a copy of John Long's book, Darwin's Devices, that we discussed in the first hour of this show. Your participation now counts. And the number is?
888-694-6931. 1-888-694-6931, or go to kera.org, click on the support banner at the top of the page, and make your contribution there.
Thanks.